Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Neo-fascism and white supremacy have a long history in the United States, but in recent years, white nationalist groups have stepped back into the spotlight, revived and rebranded as the alt-right movement. The movement, which was once loosely organized and largely kept in the shadows, has become increasingly visible. It has enjoyed a major impact on American culture and our politics and our language. In her new book, Alexandra Minna Stern explores alt-right identity and motivations and the rise of white power nationalism in American culture and politics. Alexandra Minna Stern, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
So this has become part of our political sphere as well, as we saw many times, but the most dominant example probably is during a debate with President Donald Trump.
You have repeatedly criticized the vice president for not specifically calling out Antifa and other left-wing extremist groups. But are you willing tonight to condemn white supremacists and militia groups and to say that they need to stand down and not add to the violence in a number of these cities, as we saw in Kenosha and as we've seen in Portland?
Sure,
are you
I'm
prepared
willing
to specifically
do, that, but
do it?
Well, I would say almost everything I see is from the left wing, not from the right wing.
So what are you saying?
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it.
Do you want to call them? What do you want to call them? Give me a name.
White supremacists and
Proud Boys. Stand back and stand by. But I'll tell you what. Somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left, because this is not a right wing problem. This is a left
wing.
This is a left wing problem.
What did you hear? What do you think that the alt-right, Alexandra Minna Stern, what do you think the alt-right heard in that exchange?
Well, I think that the Proud Boys specifically felt called out and summoned into action. And in fact, one of the first things that they did on social media was to take those words, stand back and stand by, and add them onto their logo and begin distributing that meme. So they were basking in the attention that Trump had paid to them. More generally, it, you know, reinforced Trump's vision of the way in which he sees these dynamics, which is that the groups to blame are groups on the left and groups and supposedly Antifa, which is not really it's not a group. It's an amorphous name for some folks on the left, and there are anti-fascists, but it doesn't exist in the same form as the Proud Boys exist, as the Oath Keepers exist, as some of these other groups exist. So in some, I think they felt called out, recognized, and it reinforced, you know, the kinds of statements that he's made where, you know, as far as he's concerned, there are, quote, very fine people, end quote, you know, on the far right side.
What's America's history with these types of groups?
Well, it depends on which entry point you take into U.S. history. So we can go back to the founding of the country and, you know, looking at its history of really genocide of native populations, the forced removal of Africans to American shores, what became American shores, and so on. So we could go back that far to look at that white supremacist vision. However, what I do in my book, which you mentioned, Proud Boys in the White Ethnostate, is I really track this history more recently, over the past two decades. There's an interesting scholar of the far right named Cass Mudd, and they have made the point that, you know, there really have been four waves of the far right in the U.S. and Europe since World War II. And this wave is what they consider to be the fourth wave. And I would agree with that assessment. And one of the characteristics of this fourth wave, which is really post-2000s with increased energy and organization after around 2010, one of the defining characteristics of this wave is the extent to which it has been effective at mainstreaming itself and becoming normalized into politics and culture. And we've certainly seen that over the past decade, and certainly over the past 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, we're going to take a big, deep look at that. I want to give the number 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you have a question, a comment, an observation about what you see, what your concerns are with the Proud Boys and the white ethno state, things that have happened here locally. We saw a white supremacist group drop off flyers in the North Side neighborhoods recently. This is all familiar territory. And this is we need to talk about this as a community. What do we make of this, and how do we push back? You can use that number, 833-877-8255, to text us. You can also email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at tprsource. So in your book, let me give the full title, Proud Boys and the White Ethnostate, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. And I think that that subtitle really is what your book is about. I mean, that's the main thing. The takeaway I had is that they are being managed using language to really have an impact on what's happening right now in this area. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, one could say that, you know, book titles are always something that you work out with the publisher. So, you know, one could say that America was already warped in many ways. So this was a new form of far right warping. But certainly, you know, one of the things that we've seen over the past 5 years is, well, we've seen both the encroachment of these groups into popular culture, their recognition at times by the current president of the United States. We've also seen a rise in far-right violence over the past several years. In fact, 2019 was the most violent year in terms of domestic terrorism since 1995, which your listeners might know is the year of the Oklahoma City bombing. And the perpetrators of this violence, of this domestic violence, have been overwhelmingly white supremacist extremists. And there has also been a rise in hate crimes. The FBI recorded hate crimes, most notably against Latinos, Jews, and LGBTQ people. So we've seen those dynamics over the past several years. One of the elements that I was really interested in, and that was one of the reasons I wrote the book, was I wanted to understand some of the more subtle ways in which our language was changing and some of the ways in which culture was kind of tipping its hand, so to speak, to the far right. And a lot of that has happened via social media, via radicalization on social media. And, you know, at least in 2016, the effectiveness of some on the all right in terms of memeing and really propagandizing for Trump and helping to get him elected.
A word, let's talk about a specific word. We can talk about how language is being hijacked and warped for these conversations and how that impacts all of us. Look, the word invasion, how has that been used?
Yeah, I think that's a really good example. Now, and that points out two things. It points out first that term invasion has a much longer history, and a history that is quite relevant to where you are on the U.S.-Mexico borderlands, where Mexicans and other immigrants were construed really starting in the early 20th century as, even though it was often their homeland, as aliens, invaders, polluters, contaminators, and others. So that word both carried almost health connotations of contamination, as well as national security connotations of invasion. We see that ramp up more in the 1940s and 50s with things like Operation Wetback in across the border. And then more recently, and, you know, everything involving the militarization of the border has often relied on that term invasion.
So let's be clear. I just want to make sure everyone knows that Operation Wetback was the official term used during the Eisenhower administration for the forced removal of people in the United States that they thought were here without authorization. And there were American citizens who were part of that as well.
Yeah, thank you so much for clarifying that. And my point there was that both had, you know, was involved demonizing largely Mexicans, and viewing them as a threat to the national security in that kind of cold, those kind of war and Cold War ideologies. What we see more recently, however, with the rise of the far right, is the way in which that term invasion has really been seized upon by groups in the U.S. and Europe and beyond, and projected onto immigrants, refugees, those seeking asylum, and how that term is connected directly to demographic anxieties and worries that the majority white status in the U.S. will be lost by 2045, according to U.S. Census projections. So the kind of talking points that you often find among white nationalists is that the quote-unquote invasion of immigrants and others, really non-white people, is unrelenting. And if action is not taken, it will result in, you know, what terrifies them, the browning, the complete browning of America. And I would also mention that, you know, invasion is a term that, and I think you're right to pick that out, that circulates among far-right groups, and it also, as we know, is a term that is embraced by someone who I would qualify on the far-right as having white nationalist ideologies, someone like Stephen Miller, as well as obviously Trump himself and other key actors involved in Homeland Security and ICE and all of the abuses that are going on around detention and immigration.
Right. So, but we see that also those terms then being used in the right-wing media.
Exactly.
As a legitimate term. And then we did see Acosta from CNN asking Trump if that was an appropriate term. And he said, I think it's appropriate. I think it's perfectly appropriate. What would you call it? They're invading the United States. And he, without apology.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the kind of, that term and other terms are terms where we really need to contextualize them, historicize them, and show how they are really weighed down with racism and xenophobia, and they work to dehumanize groups of people.
So this, how that word is trafficked, just we're just using that one particular one. We could pick several of them and make the same examination. But to go from a right-wing blog into the talking points that we may have in right-wing media, and then it goes into the political sphere, and now that's just the way people will address this issue as a normalized way of looking at it. Is that what you mean by when you say the warping of America's imagination?
Well, I would say so. I mean, there's a variety of different dimensions happening at the same time, but one of them certainly is the fact that words that may have meant something on the fringes or may have been seen as extreme become normalized, and they become the kind of the key talking points for any type of political discussion.
And then you see them echoed in headlines in a normal newspaper, in an AP news story.
That's right. So that's the kind of work of normalization where I feel it's really important to see that kind of traffic and those trajectories, and to also be able to decode what that language actually means. So, for example, another example would be, and some of your listeners may remember, when Trump started tweeting about South Africa because he was ostensibly concerned about the takeover of white farmlands by black South Africans. That is part of a whole narrative of basically white genocide and white extinction and fear of takeover by black and brown populations that white nationalists maintain.
That has a long history with the Republican Party using those talking about what's happening to white farmers in South Africa. And Ronald Reagan did that as well. We're taking a break. We're talking about the book, The Proud Boys and the White Ethnostate, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. If you have a question or comment, we'd love to hear from you. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We've got some callers on the board. We'll get you on the air when we come back from this break. Stay with us.
Estimates are that every dollar drop in the price of oil per barrel means Texas suffers an $85 million loss in annual economic impact. Hi, I'm Paul Flav. We go to the people living those losses now on the next episode of TPR's podcast, The Shakeout.
It is horrendously stressful, and it's unrelenting because 9 times out of 10, the decisions and what's happening are totally and completely out of your control.
Find that episode on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are found.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the core ideas of the alt-right and white nationalism. What's going to happen now that we're going to have a different kind of presidency? Will these groups still be turning to people like Donald Trump for some sort of leadership? If you have a question or a comment as we talk about the book, Proud Boys and the White Ethnostate, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination, call in. We're joined by the author, Alexandra Minna Stern. And let's go to the callers. And we have one here, Samir. Samir, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for having me. Great discussion, guys. I guess I kind of have more of a pessimistic macro view on this. I mean, you can see a direct line from Reagan to Trump as far as this type of stuff that's going on with the Proud Boys, but I kind of inclined to believe Peter Turchin, I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work, that the Pandora's box is open. You're not going to put this back, especially if, as you said, this is the fourth wave of this. The other previous waves didn't have social media and the internet. Now with Parler coming on, they're leaving Twitter and Facebook. I just don't see how you can stop this other than maybe on a either broad institutional basis, like Facebook clamping down on stuff, Southern Poverty Law Center, or just parents talking to their kids, because I see this as radicalization of people, kind of similar to, you know, jihadists or other groups that radicalize people online. And I think however you stop those types of radicalization, those type of techniques probably need to be used for people who are becoming Proud Boys and, you know, worse. But I kind of have a pessimistic view as far as we're past the tipping point. I just want to hear your comments about that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Alexandra Minna Stern, what do you think?
Well, I share many of the concerns of the caller. I mean, first of all, I would agree that social media has been absolutely instrumental in the growth and the amplification of these groups and their messages, and not just in the U.S., but this is a global phenomenon. And there are extensive transnational networks, particularly between the U.S. and Europe, in terms of these ethno-nationalist, identitarian, white nationalist actors. At the same time, deplatforming does have an effect. It is kind of a whack-a-mole type situation where if someone is deplatformed from Twitter, they will go to Gab. The caller mentioned Parler. They'll go to Parler. They'll go to BitChute. So there are plenty of new social media platforms that are emerging. However, you know, the most the Twitter and Facebook are still seen as kind of some the premier sites, right, for most social media, micro celebrities, as some call them, and influencers. I would say now one of the most common refrains that you see among ethno-nationalists in the U.S. and Europe is a concern for demography and changing demographics. And I really think our discourse around that needs to change and needs to shift. There's a lot of fear about the clock ticking towards, as I mentioned before, 2045, 2050. And that is generating this desire among a good number of white nationalists to create a white ethno state, to create a sustainable societies where, you know, that are racially separate and so on. But I'm very concerned going forward. I'm concerned both because of the social media element and the difficulty both at deplatforming and then the hesitance of, for example, Zuckerberg he still has not taken Holocaust deniers off of Facebook. He said he would, and he has not done it. Some of them still maintain Twitter accounts. So, you know, there needs to be more consciousness and more regulation along those lines. At the same time, you know, there are new and growing groups. So the Southern Poverty Law Center counts right now 940 hate groups in the United States and just under 30 in the state where I live in Michigan, where some of these actors got together to come up with a plot to kidnap and kill the governor. And, you know, there are a range of these organized. So there's both in real life groups, there's social media presence. And I think what you find is just as why did the alt-right emerge? It emerged in part in the context of 2008 with Barack Obama's election. It was a reactionary movement in part because of concerns of having a black president. Now in 2020, Biden has been elected, and that is going to catalyze many of these actors to feel like the race war needs to happen to embrace these doctrines they have of accelerationism, and also wanting to, you know, in their words, you know, protect white American heritage against what they will see as the diversity cabinet of the Biden administration. So, yeah, I'm deeply concerned. And I'll stop talking now, but we can talk about de-radicalization if you're interested in that topic as well.
I'm going to get to these other callers really quick. I got a lot here, so let me just try and keep our answers a little short here. But the cycle may be, and we saw, you mentioned Oklahoma City, that bombing. Before the bombing, we had Beau Gritz and all these militia movements. And once the bombing happened, they got put back in the bottle. I mean, could something else happen here? Or it's like, well, if El Paso didn't stop it, if the kidnapping attempt of the governor didn't stop it, then it's not going to happen.
Well, I would say that, you know, maybe with the Oklahoma City bombing, you know, that literally exploded into view, and many people were not aware that any type of this white power leaderless resistance militia activity was going on. It still continued, the damper was put on it, but those groups continued to organize. You know, Stormfront, which is a white supremacist message board and kind of movement space, was organized in the 1990s. So I think these groups continued to organize and to work and were often not on the radar, but they have not gone away. They have gained, as we have discussed, new traction in the 21st century. But I think, you know, if the Biden administration really takes this very serious problem, you know, to heart, then there is going to have to be really added resources and teeth, so to speak, given to various agencies that would be responsible for tracking and stemming extremism.
Let me go to Miguel on the phone. Miguel, hi. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi, yes, great conversation today. Really excited about it. I would like to ask the author just if she thought, I used the word repudiation earlier, and I think it's a little bit of the wrong word. If she thought that in 2016, that the meme movement, the meme war online, was more of a repudiation of the typical corporate left, because the left inhabits the typical pop culture sphere generally already. So was that kind of a repudiation of that, especially since they were a little bit weaker in 2016? And also how the shifting demographics are going to affect us down here as somebody who is both POC and white. And we're only 40 years removed from like Aztlan down here, where they were trying to set up a Mexican ethno state. So, I mean, I'm not too scared about a white ethno state. I'd like to hear how the far right is dealing with that. specifically. Thank you so much.
All right, Miguel, thank you for the call. Alexandra Minna-Stern.
Yeah, so I would say it's an interesting word, repudiation. I would say that for the alt-right, they really viewed kind of their, what they would see as their, you know, meme victory as a slap in the face against the left, but using the tools of the left. So a lot of what the alt-right and the far-right has done is they have built ideas about changing culture and, you know, jamming culture hard to break it on their own terms, using tools from the left, becoming, in their words, the new counterculture. And this goes back to kind of neo-fascism in the, from the 30s to the 60s, where, you know, these far-right actors look to communist or socialist theorists such as Antonio Gramsci or the Frankfurt School to put together their very own ideas of how to, let's say, warp American or European culture. In terms of, you know, it's interesting you ask about Atzfon, because one of the Bibles, so to speak, of the far right is this book that's actually titled The Ethnostate, that talks about the need for a white ethnostate. It was published in the 1990s. And one of the examples that is used as a kind of model is actually Atzlan itself, because it was, and again, this is taking ideas from the left, from, you know, really from anti-racist actors and decolonial actors on the borderlands to put together a vision of what that white ethnostate should look like. So I think we'll hear more. These words aren't going to go away, such as ethnostate, which a lot of people had never heard of until really the past several years.
So that is talking about racial separation, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's, let me just clarify something really quick, because I think it is important, is that one of the white nationalists like to distinguish themselves from white supremacists, because what they say is, we don't want to be a minority white group ruling over brown and black and minoritarian populations, such as in going back to the South Africa example. What these white nationalists say they want is their own homogenous homeland, as they like to call it, where it's whites only. And if every, they think that biodiversity means each culture and each race in its own space, on its own terms. That's the kind of diversity that they can embrace, the segregated diversity. And so in the wildest dreams of white nationalists, what this will mean is a white ethnostate, for example, in the Pacific Northwest or in the Northeast or in places where there already is about 80% white population. Certainly not in California or Texas. As
right.
far as they're concerned, that can be, you know, returned to being Aztlan.
Aztlan, which is a like a mythological land for Mexicanos or Chicanos or Mexican-Americans. Well, we're taking a break. We'll be right back. We're going to continue talking about the Proud Boys and their white ethnostate. We're going to hear from them in their own words of what they stand for. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the phone, Alexandra Minna-Stern. Her book is Proud Boys and the White Ethnostate, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. And this is, in his own words, one of the founders of the Proud Boys, Gavin McInnes, about what the Proud Boys stand for.
I started this gang called the Proud Boys.
We will kill you. That's the Proud Boys in a nutshell. We will kill you. We look nice. We seem soft. We have boys in our name. But like Bill the Butcher and the Bowery Boys, we will assassinate you.
Fighting solves everything. We need more violence from the Trump people. Trump supporters, choke a motherfucker. Choke a bitch. Choke a bitch. Get your fingers around the windpipe.
I want violence. I want punching in the face. I'm disappointed in Trump supporters for not punching enough.
Get a gun.
Get ready to blow someone's head off. I've even killed people in my dreams. That's how awesome my gun is.
Get in trouble, get arrested, get fired. Let's all get in this together.
And so, Alexandra Minna-Stern, when you hear that this coming from this individual, he presents himself in highly stylized fashion and almost packaging these ideas in an attempt to be kind of cool.
Yeah, I think that one of the aspects of the alt-right is its attempt to be kind of a hipster movement to appeal to younger people, millennials and so on, and that is part of their whole campaign, and you know, stylistically that's what they do. There are a few other things to pull out of the quotes that you just shared. The first is, you know, it's not like all of these groups are aligned in step with Trump and Trumpism. In fact, many of them are dissatisfied with Trump. They don't feel like he went far enough, for example, with the border wall, with anti-immigration, with a range of different policies that he claimed he was going to enact and did not. So it's, they will support him over the Democrats, most usually, but it's not like they're aligned completely. And the other point is that, you know, one of the things we hear in the clip you shared is the extent to which this is very much of a macho, misogynistic movement. And that really is an important aspect of the alt-right and white nationalism, is just how misogynistic and how male-centric it is, and how sexism as well as homophobia and transphobia run through it. It's one of the main currents that runs through the alt-right and white nationalism.
So there's another, this is now the chairman, current chairman of the Proud Boys, Enrique Tarillo, and he has a different way of presenting what they are.
So ask what the Proud Boys are, in just like the simplest terms, we're a drinking club with a patriot problem is all we are. We don't take ourselves seriously. Actually, outside of media coverage, we're not a boring crew, but we're a boring story. Like, if you really knew who we were on the inside, it's a boring story. It's like, it's not newsworthy at all. So we've become these monsters. And last week, we became public enemy number one for Democrats because they refused to denounce Antifa. And they had a problem. They had a problem in the polls. They knew they weren't polling right because of that. And they needed to point a finger. They needed to find somebody. And they could have, Biden could have picked so many other groups. When they were talking about white supremacy, which is an ideology, or militias, which are actual groups, you could name those. But they decided he made a critical mistake in mentioning the Proud Boys when talking about militias were not a militia. You know, we don't train white supremacy. We're not white supremacists. My chapter consists of 90% of the membership in my personal chapter are all Cubans. The minority is white.
So, Alexandria Ministern, what are we to believe? Are they a drinking club, or are they out there to bring about change, political change through violence?
Well, I would say it's a little bit of both. So, yes, I mean, one of the aspects of the Proud Boys is, you know, from the get-go, Gavin McGinnis described it as a group that was open to men of all races, both gay and straight, and they were agnostic on the Jewish question, which meant that they ostensibly were not anti-Semitic. However, what we have seen over the years, and this group was founded in 2016, is that the rank-and-file membership, for the most part, they're not all white. They do include some men of color, but they are very xenophobic. They're very Islamophobic. And as I mentioned before, they like to do a lot of macho chest thumping. Another hallmark of the Proud Boys is they like to have their cake and eat it too. They like to use these clever terms and really engage in what I would call plausible deniability. And that's a lot of what they're doing online, is saying, well, we're really not that bad, or that was just a joke, can't you take it, and so on. I will mention that Enrique Tarillo, as I understand it, was recently ousted as the leader of the Proud Boys, and there's a new head of the organization who wants to be much more explicitly white supremacist. I don't know where all of that is going. There's a lot of infighting and backstabbing in these groups themselves, and a lot of power plays, and that's part of their dynamics.
Well, what about the history of these types of groups? I'm going to include Nazi stormtroopers and black shirts from someone like Oswald Mosley, who will present themselves as a club, and then they will do violence in the streets to give plausible deniability to politicians.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we've seen with the Proud Boys, particularly in Portland, where they've teamed up with Patriot Prayer and have engaged in a lot of brawls and, you know, violence. So, yeah, they are, I would say, they could be categorized alongside those types of groups as well. But there is, again, it's not that they don't know how to normalize themselves or how to present themselves as just boys being boys, which is one of the ways in which they try to recruit people and to make it seem like, you know, good fraternal fun and just beer drinking.
Right. I'm going to get another caller here. This is Lee. And Lee, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to hear what the author has to say about the left's responsibility in the rise of these groups because of the white shaming that has gone on over the last decade. I mean, there's a case to be made that, you know, that the left and that white shaming caused, you know, Donald Trump to get elected because people looked for something that looks like them or thinks like them. I would like to hear what she has to say about this. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee, for your call. So, Alexandra Ministern.
Well, I would say on to some level that, you know, term, and thank you for calling, the white shaming talking point is one that is popular among some on the far right, where there's the sense that, you know, if you are born white, you're just guilty in American society of causing all these depredations and harm. So that is a talking point. I would say that, you know, one of the things we've seen among these groups and more generally is this idea that there is something that could be construed as white identity politics. And those on the right like to make the case, well, there's black pride and Latino pride and queer pride. Why can't there be white pride? Why is that so problematic? And the reason that it's problematic is because of its historical and cultural baggage and the fact that this is a country, from my perspective, that was built on white supremacy and needs to deal with its demons.
So there have been people who have joined these groups and thought that there was room for them, and then they found out, no, there's not. And I'm thinking of someone like Lauren Southern, who was a female who was a rising star in the alt-right, speaking these words, and then she found out that the Proud Boys and other groups don't want to have anything to do with her because she's a woman.
Yeah, I mean, she's someone who is now, I think she's kept kind of one foot in the alt-right in the sense that she has come back to Twitter, and now she's doing another documentary ostensibly on police violence and related themes. She had a large fan base, you know, hundreds of thousands of followers on Twitter and elsewhere. But I would say that she's someone who wants to, again, kind of, you know, have it both ways in terms of engaging with the alt-right. And, you know, she's someone who did a tour with Stefan Molyneux, who has since been deplatformed from YouTube and Twitter because of his increasingly overt support of white nationalism. They did a tour together where she wore a shirt, you know, it's okay to be white, and made a lot of white nationalist talking points. So I think you have to look carefully at the rhetoric, and, you know, some of these key actors using this rhetoric, they know how to use it to try to shield themselves and how to you know, how to use dog whistled language, so to speak.
Do you think we're turning a corner now with the election of Joe Biden? Good or bad? We've got about a minute here.
Well, we're definitely turning a corner. I would say very concerning, and this is not going away. This problem is not going away. What shape it's going to take, I can't exactly tell you, but it is not going away.
Alexandra Minastern is the author of Proud Boys and the White Ethno-State, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. I want to thank you so much for helping us understand what this world is all about.
Thank you.
And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks so much for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Ken Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by Ruben Garcia and Kathleen Creedon. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.